Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel teaches Messianic Judaism for all nations, and we would like to be your long-distance congregation. If you listen regularly at BethEmmanuel.org, consider supporting us with regular financial gifts and become a virtual member. Click on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org to learn more.
So today, as I was telling the children, is called the Sabbath of Consolation, because on this day, like it says in the back of the bulletin, we begin to read the Haftarah portions from the prophets, these passages of consolation. They're called seven consolations that occur over seven subsequent Sabbaths. And so we heard the first one this morning during the liturgical service. And they're all readings from the book of Isaiah that pertain to the final redemption, the restoration of Zion, and the revelation of the kingdom of heaven on earth. And these seven consecutive Sabbaths, the seven Sabbaths of consolation, bring us pretty much to the end of the Torah cycle. They are seven prophecies meant to comfort and encourage the Jewish people after the anniversary of the fall of Jerusalem, which we observed last Sunday with the fast of Av. And we have a tradition here, as most Messianic congregations do, of reading the New Testament in addition to the traditional synagogue readings from the Torah and the prophets. And as I said, most Messianic Jewish congregations do this. You know, I don't think I've ever been in a Messianic Jewish congregation where they just do the traditional synagogue readings. In every Messianic Jewish congregation I've ever been in, there's also an additional reading from the New Testament, but there's no agreement on what that additional reading should be. There's lots of different ways to do it. Some cycles go from Matthew to the end of Acts. Some cycles work their way through the whole story of the life of Jesus. Some cycles choose New Testament passages that have some connection with the Torah portions. There are all sorts of different ways. Here's what we do here as of the last, I think this is our second year on this. What we use here was created by Messianic Rabbi Paul Saul. Yes, that is his real name. And Messianic Rabbi Mark Kinzer. And perhaps there were others involved in the project too, from the MJRC and UMJC. But let me explain to you how it works. The reading cycle that they created follows the life of the Master, beginning with his birth, of course, the birth narratives, in the fall when the Torah cycle starts. So you're actually around Sukkot. You are reading about, you know, the beginning of the life of Yeshua, all the way up until last week, Tisha B'Av. And it concludes with the crucifixion. It makes the crucifixion coincide with the fast of Av, which is the anniversary of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And so as you read the story of the Master's death, and you hear the story of the Master's death, we're also at that point in the year that's the anniversary of the fall of the temple. So the reading cycle makes a correlation between the death of Yeshua and the destruction of the Holy Temple. Then, beginning on the subsequent Sabbath, which is today being the Sabbath after the Fast of Av, and extending through the period of the seven consolations that are on the back of your bulletin, we read the resurrection narratives. So what's a greater consolation? What's a greater comfort to the human soul than the story of our risen Messiah, our risen Savior? So we read the stories of the resurrection from the different Gospels for 7 weeks. So the reading cycle is making this correlation between the resurrection of our Master and the restoration of Zion and the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the raising up of the house of God, the Messianic Age Temple. As our Master made the same correlation, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build it up again. The disciples didn't realize, it says, he was speaking of the temple of his body. So today, if you're here for the morning, if you were here this morning for the liturgical service, you heard the first resurrection narrative. And now, of course, we also read the resurrection, the passion and the resurrection story at Passover, where it belongs. And, you know, but nevertheless, our cycle correlates the destruction of the temple with the death of the Messiah on the basis of the spiritual meaning that his body is the living temple in which the Logos, the divine word, tabernacles. That's why we do that, if you were wondering. So, If you look in your bulletin, you see today that our reading from the apostles was Luke 24, 1 to 11. Luke 24, 1 to 11, the story of the empty tomb. Well, that's how it works. So last Sunday was the fast of Av, and we had a Bible study as we usually do on Sunday nights. Nothing particularly special about that, but the rule is, there's a rule in Judaism that you can't study Torah on the fast of Av. Isn't that bizarre? It's like this religion is always trying to get you to study Torah, and then it says, yeah, not today. And the reason is because it's supposed to be a day of mourning, and if you study the Bible, you're going to get happy. Because studying the Bible brings you joy. So the rule is you can't study the Bible on the fast of Av. But there's an exception to the rule. The exception is that you can study as long as it's something pertinent to the destruction of the temple. So last Sunday, we had Bible study, and I decided to talk about the signs, portents, omens, and prophecies which preceded the fast of Av and the destruction of the temple in the days of the apostles. And it's interesting, and to me, it's an interesting subject because it so closely ties in with the gospel, the message of the master, the death of the master, the story of the apostolic community of believers who lived through those days. And as you know, our master concerned himself primarily with preaching the good news of the kingdom, saying, repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And what he meant by that was that if people repented, he could bring the kingdom. But if they did not, the threat of exile hung over them. And they did not. And so a countdown began from the death of the master. From the death of the master, the Lord gave the generation 40 years. Our master died and rose during Passover in the year 30 AD. And 40 years later, at Passover, in the year 70 AD, the Roman legions encompassed Jerusalem, and the siege began. That period of 40 years corresponds to the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, which began the day the 10 spies gave their report on the land, and the people rejected the promised land. And God consigned them and doomed them to die in the wilderness because they refused to enter the promised land, which is all explained in the book of Hebrews, that it represents the kingdom, the rejection of the kingdom. And of course, that day was Tisha B'Av, the fast of Av, when they rejected the land. And we learned all this, and I know I keep driving this home, but I keep driving it home because it's a key to understanding the gospel message. And as we learned, if you were at the class last Sunday, you learned that there was a whole series of signs and omens and portents that occurred warning people about the coming calamity and in the days of the apostles. And several of these began, it says, quite specifically in the Talmud, in Jewish literature, 40 years before the destruction of the temple. So the Talmud in Jewish tradition says 40 years before the destruction of the temple, these things began to happen, which means that these things began to happen in the year our master died. And they continued 40 years until the destruction of the temple. For example, we learned last week that in the year the master died, the lot for the goat of Azazel always came up in the high priest's right hand, which is a bad omen. It was considered a bad sign. I mean, there was a 50-50 chance that the lot for the Lord would come up in his hand, or the lot for Azazel would come up in his hand. 50-50 chance, but for 40 consecutive years, it was the lot for Azazel coming up in his right hand. That's like flipping a coin 40 times and getting heads every time, every single time in a row. Beginning the year the master died 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the scarlet cloth at Yom Kippur, at the Day of Atonement, which used to miraculously whiten itself, ceased to do so. For those 40 years beginning the year that the master died, one of the lamps of the menorah in the temple would no longer stay lit. For 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the enormous Nicanor gates, the huge bronze gates of the temple, began to mysteriously open of their own accord. And then, as the days drew nearer, more and more strange signs and omens began to appear. So we studied these last week. in the Sunday night Bible class, and we learned these things. But what was the meaning of these signs and omens? What was God trying to communicate and signify? Well, the meaning was quite clear, especially to the rabbis of that day. They saw these as warnings and presages of a coming destruction of Jerusalem and a disaster for the people. And we could add more, we could add one more ourselves, couldn't we? You don't find this in the Talmud. You don't find it in Jewish tradition. You won't find it in Josephus. But it does appear nonetheless in our Gospels. Here it is. 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the great curtain of the temple was torn in two by unseen hands, rent in two pieces from top to bottom. I've been promising for a few weeks to teach about the meaning of the tearing of the temple veil. And so this seems like a good time to do it. You know, I had to prepare a lot of material on this when I wrote Chronicles of the Messiah. And so I found a lot of interesting stuff. And it's a fascinating thing. It's obviously a really, really important moment. I mean, it happens right before Jesus dies. I mean, actually, right at the moment as he makes his final cry and he breathes his last. And it happens in God's house. So it's obviously a really important thing. But what does it mean? So here's our question for the day. What does the tearing of the veil in the temple indicate? That's the question. Does it indicate that God tore up the Torah? Yeah? Or the dispensation of the law is over? Or that the days of the temple had come to an end? Or that there would be no more sacrifices for sin? I mean, let's start by reading it. Let's at least get ourselves grounded in the Word. I'm going to turn to Mark chapter 15. Yeah, Mark 15, 37. Which, if you're using the DHE, the Delitzsch here, it's page 193. Oh, we'll start in verse, 33. It says, when it was the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And during the ninth hour, Yeshua cried out with a loud voice, Elahi, Elahi, lama shavaktani, which is interpreted, my God, why have you abandoned me? Some of the men standing there heard and said, look, he's calling to Eliyahu. One of them ran and filled a sponge with vinegar, placed it on a cane, and gave it to him to drink, and said, leave him alone and let us see if Eliyahu will come to take him down. But Yeshua gave a loud cry and breathed out his life. The curtain of the sanctuary was torn in two pieces from top to bottom. The centurion who was standing opposite him saw that his life departed with such a cry, and he said, surely this man was the Son of God. That is our text. Great. So what does it mean? You know, this question comes up all the time. It comes up every time I teach about the destruction of the temple and the signs that led up to it. And people always ask, when they hear about how Josephus recorded these things and how these things appear in the Mishnah and how they appear in the Talmud, people always ask if there's any record in those sources of the tearing of the temple veil. Everyone wonders, is there a corroborating source outside of the New Testament about the tearing of the veil in the temple? And the answer is no. Not outside the Gospels. But there is a Jewish tradition that sounds somewhat similar. Rabbinic sources make no mention of the tearing of the veil, but the Talmud does tell us that the Roman general Titus, on the day the temple was destroyed, he entered into the temple, and he took his sword and thrust it through the veil during the last moments as the temple was already in flames. And according to the legend, and it is a legend, according to the legend, blood spurted forth from the veil, and Titus, in his folly, believed that he had killed the Almighty. Did that really happen? Probably not. But we do know for sure, for real, Titus did enter into the temple in the last hour when the conflagration had already begun. And he almost certainly entered the Holy of Holies. The whole thing about the sword and the blood and that, I wonder if that did not evolve from a conflation of tradition that included the story of the rending of the curtain. And it was conflated with the destruction of the temple. But we don't know. That's speculation. So the answer is no. No corroborating source. Titus brought those, you know, by the way, he brought the curtain from the temple back to Rome with him. And his father, Vespasian, built a museum temple called the Temple of Peace to celebrate his victories. And it was on display in this museum. And then later he also had it on display in his palace. And so people could see it. There is a rabbi who's quoted in the Talmud who went, he was in Rome and he went. You know, he bought a ticket. And he went and he saw the veil. And he said, I saw the veil and I could see the blood splatters on it from the Yom Kippur ritual of the Day of Atonement ritual when the high priest would whip the blood at the curtain. Anyway, that's all. I'm getting like I'm going someplace else now, huh? Back to our question about the tearing of the veil. So here's the thing. Interpreters almost always invariably misunderstand the tearing of the veil to mean that the death of Jesus invalidated the temple and the whole Levitical system, including the sacrifices and the priesthood. Preachers speak of the tearing of the veil as Jesus striking the temple from the cross and nullifying the old covenant. I've told you this story before, but that's because it's pertinent. Once I was talking with an Orthodox Jewish friend, about this incident, you know, ultra-Orthodox. Anyway, he brought it up. I didn't bring it up. I would never bring up, whenever I was in these conversations, I was never the guy who brought these things up. So he brought it up. He says, hey, I was listening to Christian radio. I mean, what's up with that? But it's like, I was listening to Christian radio, and the preacher said that when Jesus died, the veil in the temple was torn, and that symbolized God tearing up the Torah. Is that what you believe? Well, no. But there is an almost unanimous opinion in the Christian world that the tearing of the temple veil indicates the end of the Torah system, the end of Judaism, the end of the temple, the end of the sacrifices, the end of the priesthood, the end of the Levitical worship. And Christian preachers are almost certain, they're as certain about this, it's such a foregone conclusion, they are as certain about this meaning as they are certain that Jesus changed Saul's name to Paul. But if the apostles believed that the death of Yeshua canceled the sacrificial system or abnegated the temple worship, they forgot to tell us. And they failed to desist from further participation in the temple themselves. They seemed to have missed the meaning that we're all so confident of. The apostles, see, it went right over their heads. Even Paul, right over his head. We know that after the resurrection, the apostles met and assembled in the temple. Not once, but every day. Every day, the Jerusalem community of believers assembled in the temple at the times of sacrifice. It was their church. They were there every day until they were kicked out near the beginning of the Jewish revolt. And they participated in the sacrifices too, and the priests, many priests, it says in the book of Acts, became believers, which is a big miracle. In my very short booklet, What About the Sacrifices, we address this question and this problem, and I'm not going to repeat all that material right now, but if you want a copy, I can get you a copy. But I point out in that booklet, I point out that there are three difficulties with the interpretation that the death of Yeshua canceled the sacrifices and the temple. There's more than that, but there's three that are really big difficulties. Number one, if the death of Jesus canceled the sacrifices and the Aaronic priesthood, why did he say that he had not come to cancel the law? You can't have it both ways. He either canceled it or he didn't. He can't cancel part of it and say, I didn't come to cancel it. He didn't say, I came to abolish the law. I did not come to abolish the law. I came to just cancel a part of it. That's not what he said. Okay, so number two, if the master's death and resurrection canceled the sacrifices in the Aaronic priesthood, why did his followers continue to participate in those things? That was my point here. And number three, here is a big one that is pertinent to Shabbat Nachamu and the prophecies in Isaiah and all the prophets, for that matter. It's not just Isaiah, it's also Ezekiel, it's all the prophets. If the master's death and resurrection canceled the temple and negated the temple and the sacrifices and everything, then why do the prophets predict a return of the temple, of the sacrifices, and the Aaronic priesthood in the Messianic era, in the coming kingdom? So these are the three big problems with that interpretation. And I'm going to, in our seven consolations, we read about these prophecies, the coming of the Messianic era and the kingdom. We're talking about the restoration of Jerusalem, Messianic Jerusalem, the house of God, the holy temple. So what happens? What's going to happen when are we saying the Messianic era gets here, the Messiah comes, and he's going to have to sew that thing back up. He's like, you tore it, you better sew that thing back up. I don't know. Moses? You wrecked my tablets. Now, carve out two new stone tablets and get back up here on this mountain. Kind of like that. Maybe it's like that. Moses comes down, he sees his golden calf, he's like, don't! He throws those tablets down. God says, Moses, I needed those. I don't believe that the tearing of the veil is meant to indicate the cessation of the Levitical system, Aaronic priesthood, or the sacrifices. I think you know that. I don't believe that. Anyway, if you want to find out, I have a book. I will get you a copy. It's a very short booklet, right? I mentioned. But you might also want to come to the Bible study tomorrow night, where we'll be talking about the Day of Atonement in the Book of Hebrews, and we'll kind of come around this issue again a little bit. Tomorrow night. But here's the question then. If the tearing of the veil does not indicate the cessation of the sacrifices in the Levitical system, what does it symbolize? And now for a rabbit trail. Before I can address that, I have to address another question, because Steve Peterson is here. Which veil are we talking about? It says the curtain of the sanctuary. But the temple, here's the problem, the temple had more than one curtain. The temple in the days of the master had an outer veil at the entrance to the holy place and two inner veils at the entrance to the Holy of Holies. Two, so count them. Now we're up to three. So there's basically three potential curtains that we could be talking about here. So let's go through these. We'll pretend this is the holy temple. Like, this is the inside of the holy temple, all right? And right back there where you have those big windows, we'll make that the big grand entrance doors into the holy temple, okay? And so you have the big giant grand entrance doors into the holy temple, and only the priesthood can come in here. And we really don't want people peeking in here and looking at the things of which it says that only the priesthood is to look up upon. So we don't want people like peeking and looking at the menorah and stuff like that and trying to watch the priestly services going on in here. So we have the doors open, we put up a big veil right there, a big curtain, and there's a big curtain hanging there. That's the outer veil, and everybody can see that one, all right? Then we have the inner veil. See, back here where the ark is, we'll call this the Holy of Holies, right? And so we actually have two veils here. One veil starts at this wall, the outermost veil. It's actually like touches the wall. It's touching the wall, and it's going to run all the way across to about we'll say it stops right here in front of Troy's junk. Okay? It stops about right there. And then the other veil is about a cubit behind it. All right? And it starts at that wall. And it runs all the way. Now, it's running parallel. This is a parallel line. And it's running all the way back here, and it stops before reaching that wall. And so the way that the priest enters into the Holy of Holies when he has to go in on the Day of Atonement, right? How's he going to get in here? Can't get in here. So he's got to walk over here, right? He's got to walk all the way over here, cut through Troy's stuff, because, and then he comes to where the veil, there's a veil right here, and now he walks back like this. So he's walking between the two veils. So he walks all the way back like this, and then he can pop through over here where this one ends, and now he's in the Holy of Holies. Walks back, and now puts his incense down and lights it and that sort of thing. Back and forth, back and forth. He's in and out of the Holy of Holies several times on the Day of Atonement on these different errands. So, but the thing is, two veils hanging there and one out there. So we have three potential veils that we could be talking about when it says the veil of the temple was torn in two. Which veil? Which curtain? Which one are we talking about? Well, here I'll read you something from Shimon ben Gamliel. You know Shimon ben Gamliel, the son of Gamliel? You know Gamliel, Paul's teacher Gamliel from the book of Acts? Okay, this is his son, Simon. Simon says, the fabric of the veil in front of the Holy of Holies was a handbreadth thick. Wow, that's really a thick veil, isn't it? It was woven of 72 strands. Each strand consisted of 24 threads. The veil was 40 cubits long, 20 cubits wide. It was made by 82 young girls. And they made two new veils, this work crew of 82 young girls, made two new veils every year. And it took 300 priests to immerse it. So they would wash these veils and they would immerse these veils, purify these veils. And they would produce two of them a year. And it took 300 priests because of the weight of this enormous thing. You can imagine it, when it gets full of water, it's going to be very heavy. It took 300 priests to handle one of these veils. I am especially intrigued by the 82 girls that make the veils. It's interesting to me because there's an apocryphal Christian tradition from Proto-Evangelium James, which is for the most part a book of junk. But there is this apocryphal tradition in Proto-Evangelium James that before her marriage, Miriam, the mother of the Master, was one of the girls who made the temple veils. Isn't that cool? Mary, the mother of the Master, was one of the 82 girls. And so whenever you see a picture of Mary, it's an Annunciation picture. Whenever you see, you know, there's the angel Gabriel, and then Mary is like, here is, what's she doing? She's sewing. She's got a big red bolt of cloth, and she's sewing. And the angel Gabriel is saying, Hail Mary, full of grace. And she's sewing on this big bolt of cloth. And that's because of that tradition, that legend, that she was one of the girls who made the veil. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. But, so now we understand. There's three veils. So the question is, which one of these three veils tore from top to bottom? There's an argument that the torn veil must have been the outer veil. And here's how the argument proceeds. Because if it was the inner veil, only the priesthood would know about it. If it's a sign for the people, it must have been the outer veil, because the people in the courtyard, you know, all the worshipers that are there, can only see the outer veil. They can't see the inner veil. So that there's some logic there. Then there's this one. Here's another argument you'll hear sometimes. Remember what the centurion says. The veil tears, and then the centurion, it says, when he saw how this man died, he said, truly, this was the Son of God. So according to this argument, the centurion must have seen the veil tear at the moment that Yeshua died, and then he came to that conclusion. So therefore, it had to be the outer veil. for him to see it. But that doesn't hold up at all. Because, okay, first of all, none of the gospel narratives indicate that the centurion or anyone else at the cross witnessed the tearing of the veil. In fact, it doesn't say anything about anyone seeing the veil tear. And the geography of the story, if you know Jerusalem at all, the geography of the story makes it impossible, absolutely impossible, that he could have been at the cross and seen, you know, he could have been at Golgotha and seen the outer veil of the temple. You can't see from there to there. Unless, to fix the problem, you put the crucifixion up on Mount Scopus, where Rabbi Akiva was laughing at the fox coming out of the Holy of Holies, like I told the children. So you put the crucifixion up on the Mount of Olives or something like this, so it's overlooking the Temple Mount, and that's what you have to do to explain that. And that's absolutely, it just doesn't work. That's not what happened. It did not happen on the Mount of Olives. Golgotha is not the Mount of Olives. And there's other problems with the idea that it was the outer veil instead of the inner veil from a literary perspective. I mean, look at it from the point of view of literature. The gospel reader naturally assumes, if you're the reader and it says the veil of the temple, your natural assumption is that it refers to the inner veil that screened the Holy of Holies. So these two inner veils. The gospel doesn't mention more than one veil. It doesn't modify it. It doesn't say the outer veil, inner veil. It just says veil of the temple. And you would think if it was the outer veil, in order to avoid the obvious misunderstanding that would come to the reader's mind, the gospel writer would add the modifier to clarify and say the outer veil of the temple. Moreover, if the outer veil of the temple tore during Passover, there would be thousands of witnesses. The gospel doesn't record anything about the crowd reaction. And the people were astonished. You don't hear that. Also, the book of Hebrews, which does reflect a knowledge of an inner veil and an outer veil, in Hebrews 9, it says the second veil, the first veil. The book of Hebrews connects the death of the Messiah with passage through the inner veil, as we'll talk about tomorrow night. But it ties no significance to the outer veil. Like that, of that order. Finally, one more argument, Steve. Although the tearing of the outer veil might have served as a foreboding omen and sign of God's displeasure, it lacks the theological significance of the tearing of the inner veil. It is the tearing of the inner veil that hung in front of the Holy of Holies from top to bottom, that has this great and vast theological significance. Whereas the outer veil would just kind of be like, whoa, that was weird. So we can assume, if Steve Peterson and you outer veil people, I'm pretty sure I probably haven't changed your mind, which is fine. And we're not going to die on this hill or that hill, whether it's Golgotha or the Mount of Olives. And if you want to be unreasonable, let's just agree to disagree, because you are wrong and I am right. All right, sorry. Just for the sake of argument, we'll say it this way. Just for the sake of argument, go with me and pretend I'm right. And pretend it was the inner veil. Now, once we've pretended that, what does the tearing of the inner veil signify? And I've thought about this a lot and decided not to tell you today. Because I think it signifies a lot, a great deal. And there's several suggestions that I want to make. And I don't want to rush them and squeeze them in here real quick, you know, right at the tail end of a sermon. So if you want to find out, you know, you can come back next week. But in the meantime, I'll just say one statement to get the wheels turning. And that is that there is a connection between our holy master and the holy temple of God. A big connection that's very clear, that he is the living temple. The messianic rabbis who created our gospel reading schedule realized that. It wasn't an accident. They didn't just sort of, Rabbi Kinzer and Rabbi Saul didn't just sit down and say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we had Jesus, you know, we read about Jesus dying around Tisha B'Av when we're sad. It's much more than that. The Master's body is a living temple, the holy place of God, the dwelling place of the Almighty, of the Shekinah. And those who receive him, who become a part of him, him and us, become his body. We know this. So we use that language, the body of Christ, the body of Messiah. And therefore, the apostles teach us, we become a living temple. This is what they say. They say that we are a temple of the Holy Spirit. That's the teaching of the apostles. And because there is a connection between the temple and the Master's body, there is a connection between what happens to one and what happens to the other. So what's happened to our Master, what happened to our Master was this. His body was torn and pierced by the Romans, partially because of the corruption of the priesthood, but especially for the sin of the nation. And what happened to the temple is that it was toppled and burned by the Romans, partially because of the corruption of the same priesthood, but especially for the sin of the nation. So there is no coincidence here. There are no coincidences with God. There is no coincidence that our Master died and the veil was torn asunder.
Take on my yoke and learn from me, and find rest for your soul.